You're listening to In Healthy Company with Dr. Tim Stevenson. In this podcast, we're all about mental health and general well-being. We'll be interviewing guests and providing a safe space for them to discuss any mental health issues. For me, holistic health is far more than just not being sick. Please remember, we're unable to give health advice on an individual basis. However, please do feel free to email us with your issues at wellbeing@thehealthycompany.com. And we may deal with them on the show. I'm in healthy company today with Dee Kafari, MBE, and with Dr. Spike Briggs. I was lucky enough to be reading Dee's book, Against the Flow. And as I read the inspiring story of Dee's transition from being a PE teacher to being a record-breaking yachtswoman, sailing around the world the wrong way and an all sailing around the world six times, she inspired me in many, many ways. And it was interesting in that book to have sections where Spike Briggs, who I have known for some time, was mentioned and the support that he'd given to Dee. So I took the opportunity of contacting Spike and asking if we could all meet to have a chat. As I read Dee's book, my wife said to me, "I haven't seen you read a book that fast since 50 Shades of Grey." As I'm dyslexic, it takes me quite a bit to read a book. And I did mention to Dee that I enjoyed her book much more than 50 Shades of Grey. And I could taste the salt water. I could feel the wind on my face. And I could visualize the washing machine effect of being tumbled and tumbled in the Southern Ocean. So it was an absolute privilege to meet Dee today to discuss that, and thank you for coming on the show. One of the things that I've also heard you speak before on the psychological side of things, and that's very much what Healthy Company is about how we speak to ourselves, how we speak to each other. And I'm interested in how you prepared for the voyage, Spike, how you helped, if you helped in any way from the psychological point of view, but you know, also from the physical, and people would be interested in just your preparations for the first time, and then what you learned from each one, and just...
Yeah, it's interesting. My first round the world was a skipper on the Global Challenge, and Spike was our medical support, and so he knows intimately what you're carrying, and then can help and advise, because the biggest thing that I've learned through working with them is it's your responsibility on the boat. Like everything, the buck stops with you as the skipper, but if you can share that responsibility by talking to somebody of, I have this medical issue, and by literally sharing the information, you share that burden of responsibility to a certain extent. It does make a big difference. It makes you feel that you're not alone, even though you're out there in the middle of the ocean. And actually, the round the world that I did, we had one of the biggest Southern Ocean rescues that's ever been done. And Spike was with us every day through that, which went on for 10 days. So it was a biggie. Mm. And then off the back of that, I decided to take the exact same boat without the 17 people on my own. And therefore, I sat next to Spike and said, how do I do this? And it was interesting. I remember being sat on the boat where he said, so if you were to break your arm, you want to sit here and you want to put your medical kit here. And we thought about everything that we hadn't done before when there was a crew around. But actually, the impact of by being on your own, where you position stuff, where you're going to sit and do stuff, and various things that could happen to you. Head injuries, I'm right-handed, so right-hand injuries would be an issue. And the knock-on effect of that was huge, and we had to look at all of that. And I remember having that session on the boat. I remember going to his house, going through the medical kit and understanding it. And I'm not medically trained, so all the proper names, all the fancy names, I had to kind of translate. And we had laminated sheets, you know, that kind of just said it in my language, so that when you're tired and emotional, it's easy. And I still have those sheets of where the medical name and actually what it does in my language. Mm-hmm. So I can relate to that quite easily. And little things that I hadn't thought of, but obviously he was aware, and we had a few calls along the way, didn't we?
Spike, you're not just an ordinary doctor like me. You've sailed around the world. I've done lots of sailing, but I haven't sailed big trips. So you've sailed yourself.
I think it's an advantage in a way, in that it gives you a very good idea about about the environment that yachts people are working in, and I think that's very important. And it gives you an idea about the kind of the mental stresses that you go through as well. I was lucky because I did it with a crew of 14, so there's always somebody to talk to or to depend on. And I can honestly say that I didn't perform at 100% on the boat for all the time, and. But there were other people who could back up. But when you're out there by yourself, that's the ultimate impressive thing to do.
Absolutely. I was sort of, it struck me about loneliness of, and I've got a boat and I actually like to skipper it and I don't like anyone else skippering it because I want to be responsible. But it's a lonely place when things are going wrong. And, if you're responsible for other people. So your loneliness, yeah. I struck by both types of loneliness in a way.
And it is interesting, I've sailed on my own and actually you're so busy. People say, do you get bored or do you get lonely? But actually you're so busy in a 24-hour period, it's hard to believe. But for months at a time, you're either sailing the boat fast or you're fixing something that's broken or you're doing some media or you're navigating or you're downloading weather or you're eating, sleeping or drinking. And then, that's your day filled almost. And then you're meant to enjoy it along the way as well. And actually, sometimes it can feel more lonely when you're actually responsible for the team. Because, it's tough at the top and you're not there to be everyone's friend and you've got to make the difficult decisions sometimes. And actually, it's a lonely place to be. I felt that, a few times during the last round the world, which was skippering the Volvo, Turn the Tide on Plastic. And it is tough at the top, but that's why, you have the responsibility. Yeah. That's why you're there. The name, and that comes with the burden of responsibility.
Absolutely, and I was thinking about your Turn the Tide and Plastic. Tell us a wee bit about that, because I didn't know about that, I'm sorry.
Yeah, so my last round the world, or my sixth time round the world, finished last year, and I did the Volvo Ocean Race and I skippered Turn the Tide on Plastic, so seven identical boats, and the professional end, the pinnacle end of round the world racing as a crew. But I just did it slightly differently. So I had a sustainability message backed by the UN Environment Clean Seas Initiative, Turn the Tide on Plastic. And I had 80% of my crew were under 30, so had never been around the world before. Were good sailors, some of them America's Cup, some of them Olympians, some of them shorthanded sailors, but had never actually done the trip around the world. And then also I had 10 nationalities on board. So I was the United Nations, which has a challenge in its own right. And I also had a 50-50 crew, five girls, five guys, to actually practice what I preach on about. I was the only female skipper yet again in a race around the world. And actually, it was a huge challenge that I didn't really realise the responsibility I was taking on until we had to leave Cape Town on a horrendous forecast to go into the Southern Ocean. And none of my guys had been down there before. And I'd sent them an email of this is how you live in the Southern Ocean to try and help them out of how to manage themselves down there. Because they were literally learning everything. But to see these guys grow and continuously improve and continuously push all the way to the end, at the end of 10 months, finishing in The Hague and not finishing behind everybody else and they're sailing against the best sailors in the world was awesome. And it's probably the project I'm most proud of, apart from my solo stuff. But it's right up there and I'm glad I took it on.
Absolutely fantastic. I was listening earlier on whenever you were talking about how close everybody finished. It was within 20 minutes or something.
We were doing 5,000 mile legs and finishing within 20 minutes.
That's amazing.
I went from being on the podium for 4,980 miles and lost it in the final 20 miles coming into Auckland Harbour. I mean, I've never been more devastated in my life. But to be part of a race that was that close and that exciting is amazing. So, yeah.
When you're talking about being devastated and that thing about the guys, I read in the first... challenge with the Shea Blythe challenge, and you had that crew and you did a wonder tack, and anybody who sails you always think about a wonder tack is either because you're either near the front and you think that's going to do it out, or you're near the back and there's no point not having a go. But there was a wonder tack and it didn't pay off, and then everyone was devastated. And how do you handle everybody else's devastation? How do you bring those guys back in as a team again? And that's
where you have to earn your leadership stripes. And I probably learnt a lot on that race about management, man management, conflict management. And I probably went out under skilled in all those areas and gained that as I went. So now I'm in a much better position to do that. But it's exhausting. It's exhausting to always find the positive spin or to pick everybody up because you're having to do it. But then when you're on your own, you have to do that yourself because there isn't somebody else to bounce off or someone else to do it for you. And, you know, then that communication to the outside world is so important that it's the right communication. So you're having to find that strength within all the time to come back fighting or come back from being behind or making a mistake or something going wrong and keep going.
When you say come back fighting, I'm just, again, I was talking to you earlier about the power of words, and I was talking to a boxer recently, and I was just, he boxes for fun. He's not a professional, but he, you know, it's his sport. And I was just talking about the adrenaline and how you, when you're boxing, are you aggressive? And you're not necessarily, you're using your sport, you're using your technique rather than being aggressive. And it's only if it's in a fiery situation with someone else that a boxer becomes aggressive. And it's the same in sailing a lot of the time. You've got to just keep your mind about you. And yes, you're still trying to win that race, but you're still also trying to entertain 15 people in a way.
Yeah, it's a balancing act. So we laughed when I did the Volvo the first time. I was part of a crew and alongside Olympians, and their races are 15 minutes. And I was saying that this was a series of short sprints, because to me, 2 weeks, 3 weeks is a sprint at sea, and it was like easy because then you get to recover and then you go again. I'd been at sea for 3 months and before that 6 months at a time. So it's your perspective on things and how it's different. And actually you need in a team everybody's different strengths to balance to get the best out of everyone and get the people in the right roles. And, you know, they might not be able to maintain themselves for 3 weeks, but for me, I can push quite hard for 3 weeks because it's relatively easy. And it's knowing when people are down and need a pickup and who those people are is helps that balance of that team and that performance then.
I was interested, Spike, maybe you can come in on this, but my big thing about seasickness, I've been, you know, even crossing the channel, when I first raced across the channel, I was seasick for the first 3 hours, got better, and then was sick when I got off again with Maldi Barkamal. But how did you, in your book, I read about the guys being seasick, and that, you know, they've all dreamt of this great voyage that they're setting out on, and then, you know, a few days in and they're puking in the Bay of Biscay. And Spike, you know, there's lots of medication you can take, but what about the psychology of seasickness? Anything you sort of prepare people with for that?
Well, it's all about preparation and pre-planning and knowing the people, because everybody's brains wired differently, and some people just don't suffer from seasickness at all. In fact, the only time I've ever been seasick at sea, because I used to work at sea as a marine engineer as well, and the only time was on the start of our round the world race, just off the Needles, and I thought, you know, God, you know, I've been seasick. I've never been seasick at sea before, and we've got another 30,000 miles to go. This is dreadful. What have I done? So everybody's brain is wired differently, and there's different circumstances can bring seasickness on, or sickness, or, you know, what we call motion illness. And so it's a question about, if you're using drugs, it's a question about, well, first of all, if somebody's, you know, just recurrently seasick, it's debilitating, and they turn from being a useful member of the crew to a passenger. And if you're racing, you really cannot afford for that to be the case, because you lose all their skill set. So particularly for racing boats, it's a question of keeping every crew member functional as possible, no matter what happens to them. And seasickness is just one of the things that can happen to them. But in terms of seasickness, it's fairly straightforward in terms of just finding the right drug which combats the right neural pathways to this thing in your brain called a vomiting centre, quite handily. And so trying to suppress that centre to stop people being sick. And some people respond to a certain type of drug, other people respond to other types of drug. So it's a very personal type of thing, you know. But it's knowing people who are susceptible to motion illness beforehand. Because it doesn't just make you sick, it makes you feel tired, it stops your gut working, you don't open your bowels for several days, and you can be at sea and get over seasickness and have a fairly calm period, but then if another big weather system comes in, you can then become seasick again. So it can come back even though you're at sea continuously.
There's an old saying when you're sailing, of I was so seasick I was worried I wasn't going to die.
Right.
I wish they had.
Yeah.
It is true, and I think a lot, I mean, you have to have a sympathy to it, but it's, you have to kind of also ignore it a little bit because they need to deal with it. And a lot of it is as psychological as it is physical.
Absolutely.
One of my girls was fearful of being seasick and didn't handle it offshore well. She's an Olympian. And her sister is an oncology doctor, and they talked about all sorts of chemotherapy drugs and all these things that stop people being sick and stuff. And she had a whole cocktail of stuff to try, and I said, try whatever works for you, I'm happy with, so long as you're okay with it, you manage it, but you need to have tried it before we go, kind of thing. I didn't want to let's go and experiment. And she managed her sickness to not impacting us at all, or none of us even knowing when she felt rough.
I mean, I think the psychological side is massive, and I mean, I still get seasick, but if I'm a skipper, I know I just have to get on with it, so I'll puke over the back and get on, and I don't worry about it. And that's very much what one of the things I was talking earlier on about, your strengths and how you handle the way you feel, and how you know, so that you're not winding yourself up and using energy negatively. So the words you use to yourself and against yourself or other people. How do you, one of the things I'm interested in is how much you learn whenever you come back from one of these trips. So like that first one that was a real eye-opener for you. What do you put into place when you're planning the next trip? Is there anything that you...
I think it's really important to take the lessons learnt, but then no two trips are ever the same, because you're not with the same boat or the same format of crew or anything the same. I went from leading 17 people to being on my own, and then various combinations over the time. But I think you still need to put into practice what worked for you. And I think if you focus maybe on the positives of the things that did work, just no awareness of the things you've suffered from before. You know, I had one where I had a really bad stomach pains, really uncomfortable, and actually, you know, the end result was I didn't rehydrate my food because I was starving and I wanted to eat, and then I suffered from it really badly. But I passed that story on to make sure nobody cuts that corner on leaving their food to hydrate properly. And it's really hard. You want to eat, you've got it in your hand, and you just want to eat it so you can get into your bunk. But actually, it's so important to let it hydrate properly. And I've been on the other end of that where I got it wrong on my own. And, you know, sending an email going, oh, I've got really bad tummy ache. And he's like, try drinking. And I was like, oh, yeah. Yeah. Try going to the toilet. Oh, yeah, freeze-dried food.
Very useful, but used properly.
Yeah, absolutely. Fear. Have you been frightened at sea?
I think it's one of those where you're aware of how scary it was after the fact. At the time, you're too busy dealing with it. And I think you manage yourself so that you aren't fearful, you get on with it, and then once you've come out the other side, you've got time to reflect on it, and then you go, God, that was a bit scary, wasn't it?
Yeah.
But as a result, you've already got through the other side, and then you're going, oh, so the next time you're like, oh, it's not as bad as last time. And it's all relative. You can get run over. Everyone's like, oh, you could die, or this is really dangerous. But actually, crossing the road is quite dangerous, and we do that every day. It doesn't stop us going out. So I think so long as you put all the perceived risks in place, and you talk to all the knowledge, and you get the advice and the support, you know, you're as good as you're going to be doing anything.
Yeah, I've been in one storm and on a boat, and it was strange. I wasn't frightened. It was just, I thought there was a high possibility we were going to die, but I wasn't actually frightened. And it was weird. I was only annoyed that I brought my son on the trip with us, and he was possibly going to be one of the ones that died as well. But it is weird. I've never been frightened. You know, as in paralysed frightened at sea. It's just a
normally there's quite a lot to do, and then once you've done it all. You just have to hang on for the ride and come out the other side, because you've taken all your sail down, or you've put the right sails up, and you've stowed everything as well you can. You just kind of have to sit and wait.
Wow. It's having the knowledge and experience, I think, of being able to cope with things. And I think if you have... The times I've felt concerned about things is when I've come to the end of what I know, and I don't know what to do next. And I'm quite good at always having a plan. And so I think if you always have a plan about what you need to do, and you're putting that plan into action, I think that keeps the fear at bay. And I think it's at times when you run out of a plan, and you're just looking at a big empty space, and you don't know what to do next. And I think that's when it starts to get frightening.
That's when your mindfulness needs to come in and
allow yourself. Or when you're responsible for other people, because then that the pressure is you're looking out for them. But then that gives you something to do. Otherwise, yeah, you just let your mind race.
What we talk about in medicine is for acute resuscitations, and this is part of telemedicine as well. So if I get a call from offshore, whatever it might be, obviously there's a lot of, as we were talking about, there's a lot of rashes, and, you know, that's one thing. But, you know, occasionally a call comes through when it is utterly life-threatening. And you can tell from the voice on the end of the phone almost immediately just how serious it is. And so part of the thing, and this is for my own practice in medicine as well, is having a framework within which to think, and to so that you always have, you know, you always have a framework within which to think, so you carry on thinking. And if you get to the end of that kind of series of actions, you go back to the beginning, you start again. So in medicine, it's like airway, breathing, circulation, but it gives you something to kind of hang on to, and also to organise your actions as well. And I think that's what we do in our medical courses for YOS people, is that we don't teach things which are particularly difficult. We just teach pretty kind of straightforward things, but we teach people how to do the things really, really well at the right time. And I think that goes for any kind of, it's almost any part of life really, but particularly your thing.
And what about sadness? Whenever you were at sea, I felt for you reading the book about being away from home on Christmas Day. And, you know, you often read about people who, you know, those sorts of moments, but there's lots of other times.
There are, but that's a selfish thought, really, because, I mean, I've chosen to be there.
Exactly.
And if you go sailing around the world, you're going to be in the Southern Ocean in the winter, because that's the best time to be there. So that's kind of like, oh, everyone else is tucking down to a really nice Christmas dinner and I'm not. Oh, look, freeze-dried food. But so I think that's like a selfish thought process, and I guess now I'm more experienced at it since I wrote the book, so it's more what I'm used to. The impact for me more recently is, you know, people don't die at sea doing what I do, because in our club, you know, we're all really good at what we do, and it's never happened, but it happened, and it happened in our family on this last Volvo Ocean race. We lost a life on another boat. And the impact it had on all the boats and all the crews was phenomenal. And to be that person on another boat, tell my crew that one of their friends was the person lost at sea, was, and it didn't matter who it was, even though we didn't know who it was for some time. The fact that we had no news, we knew it wasn't going to be good news. But it was really hurtful for me to see the pain that it created for everyone. And everyone just was different for 24 hours on the boat. We sailed different. We must have slowed down a bit. And we're in there doing exactly the same, in the same bit of water, in the same sea, doing the same thing. And, you know, realising that this environment that I was so used to, and you get quite blasé in because I'm in it so often, it's a reminder of how hostile it can be and how extreme it is and remote, and bad things can happen. And it does up everybody's safety awareness, and it makes you have each other's backs a bit more. So the result is very good, but it's that, you know, that to me was proper sadness. This time that I hadn't had to experience before.
Yeah. And what's round the corner next for you? What are you up to over the next year or two?
Still want to do more. It's getting harder to find the funds to do it. And trying to convince people that I'm the right pick for their team is quite hard because I'm getting older. So I'm working really hard at the gym to make sure that doesn't have an effect. But I've still got a thought process for how I go out there to do crazy things. So my current thinking is to build on the momentum from Turn the Tide on Plastic and look at highlighting climate change and the fact that it might even be possible to circumnavigate the North Pole non-stop because of the ice retraction really highlights that. So if I can do that, maybe next summer, and use it as a platform for some science and research at the same time, then I think that'd be pretty cool.
That's a weird one. You actually don't want to be successful.
almost want to fail to prove that we've still got a chance to reverse what we're doing to the planet. But sadly, I think it might be possible. So I thought I'd test out some more of Spike's remote medicine and see how good he is up near polar bears.
I've seen some of those emails already. That's already started.
Hopefully it's a plan. Plan A is the medical kit stays shut.
We never actually want to use it. And I'm hoping I won't be on my own. I'm hoping there'll be four of us.
That's nicer. Anyway, because thank you very much. And, there'll be links on the podcast on the write-up so that people can see where to find out more about you and about you too, Spike. So thank you very much, both.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
I really enjoyed that conversation with Dee and with Spike. and it was great to hear the preparations and the teamwork involved, even on a solo trip. I enjoyed the fact that they mentioned that along the way, even whenever there's lots to be done, it's important to enjoy the journey and enjoy it along the way. We can say that about life. Thanks for listening. You can find out much more at my website, thehealthycompany.com. If there are any areas of health and wellbeing that you would like us to explore in future podcasts, or you have any feedback, then please do email me at wellbeing@thehealthycompany.com. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.